The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. This week on the show...
What really surprises me is that no one came up with this before. I mean, it's such an obvious idea. Everybody would say the sea level comes and goes. We know that. So the only thing you've got to factor in is, well, did that expose elements of this submarine world?
Author Henry Nichols discussing the latest research on the Galapagos Islands, which indicates a key role for rising and falling sea levels and the incredible biodiversity of the birthplace of Darwin's ideas on evolution. Also, we'll be taking a look at some of this week's standout science news, including a breakthrough in stem cell research that offers hope for infertile men, human litter found in the deepest oceans, and why seed banks are needed to ensure global food security. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me to discuss this week's science news is Observer Tech Monthly commissioning editor Nicola Davis. Welcome back, Nicola.
Hello.
And for the first time on the pod, we have Jessica Aldred from the Environment Desk. Jessica, a very warm welcome to Science Weekly.
Thank you.
Jessica, we're going to kick off with you. You wrote an article looking at recent research into the extent of human litter on the seabed. What was that all about?
Well, so scientists have surveyed three areas in Europe. So they've gone to the North Atlantic, the Arctic and the Mediterranean seas. And what they found was that human litters reached the deepest part of European oceans and reached the seabed. And what's interesting about this research is that this has been found before. We've had unmanned robotic vehicles that have gone to the seabed and they've found examples of litter before. But what they've done this time is they've put their findings of the amount of litter together with the sort of the underwater geography. Mm. So for the first time, they've been able to look at the accumulation of litter in particular geographical areas, so deep sea canyons or areas just off the coastline. And it's the first study that's put those two pieces of information together.
So we've trashed now the entire planet. Is that basically what we're saying? Is that there is no place unsullied?
Yeah, I mean, they found it in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is about 2,000 kilometres away from land. And they've gone from depths of 35 metres to 4.5 kilometres deep. And probably the most depressing thing is a picture of a Heineken beer can, which they found in one of the deepest areas.
That's just PR, isn't it? is there any measure of actually how much, the quantity of stuff that's there?
No, they did count it across certain sectors, but what was one of the most interesting findings was the types of litter. So predictably, plastic was the most common type of litter, and that was 41%. But what they actually also found was huge quantities of discarded fishing material, so nets, lines, which, you know, is going to pose great problems for anything that's living that deep. And because it's so deep and it doesn't get studied that often, they don't know what the effect is on the ecosystem down there.
And will they ever? I mean, can you look at this stuff and try and see what its effects on the local ecology are going to be?
Yeah, I mean, most of the studies that have done before have concentrated on coastlines. But one of the interesting things they found was that there's not so much litter on the seabed just offshore. So you have things like rivers, which kind of push it further out into the deep trenches. I mean, I think there's particularly vulnerable ecosystems down there, like there's deep sea vents and cold water corals that haven't been studied. So they don't know what the impact of that litter is, and they can't quantify how much is down there. So I think what they're calling for is further research that kind of maps the litter to geographical areas so that we can understand the entire extent of the problem.
Nicola?
Is there any research in the pipeline about looking at how we might recover and remove this waste? I mean, surely we don't just want to say it's down there, that's part of the landscape, we want to do something about it.
Yeah, they do want a call for action about this. I think they've only just got to a stage where they can send down these sort of robot, like remote controlled vehicles to actually see the rubbish. So I think the technology must be ongoing to develop how they're going to actually recover it. But I think that's something that, you know, this is the science has presented the extent of the problem. Now it's up to the policymakers to go away and work out what they're going to do about it and how.
Presumably there might be a problem in that recovering it might disturb ecosystems second time over.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and a lot of the sort of areas there, it's accumulated levels of sand and waste that they don't know how far down it goes and what the effect might be if they go in there and start moving things around.
Presumably, it's tricky to work out who is responsible for certain areas and certain amounts of this rubbish, though, because this whole strategy of sort of polluter pays, it's hard to know who the polluter is in each
case. Yeah,
well,
it's like the emissions problem in Europe as well. I mean, a lot of this stuff could come off the coastline of Portugal and currents could take it, you know, I don't know, to the North Sea, and who's responsible for that?
Well, although if it's branded, presumably one can work out which country it comes from.
So is all this just modern waste material?
One of the most interesting things that the scientists picked out from the study was seafloor deposits of clinker, which is the residue of burnt coal that's been dumped by steamships. This was happening from the late 18th century onwards. And so the discovery of this clinker shows that they're still using the same shipping routes now that they were 200 years ago.
Thanks, Jessica. And to read that story and all of Jessica's other writing, have a look at theguardian.com/environment. Next up for discussion is some research I wrote about last week that could lead to treatments for male infertility. This was research from Stanford University where they took skin cells from infertile men, and these were men who had really quite major genetic defects on their Y chromosomes that meant their sperm don't normally develop. They don't develop to mature sperm, so it leaves them infertile. About 1% of men have this condition called azoospermia. And so they took skin cells from infertile men and reprogram them using a technique which gives you something called induced pluripotent stem cells, which are very sort of stem cell-like cells, if you like. They can be turned into pretty much anything in the body. But they put these cells into the testes of mice to see what happened to them. And what happens is in that environment, when you put it into those these tubules in the mice testes where the sperm normally develop, they turned into very early stage human sperm cells. Now, it's quite a sort of technical bit of research, but what that tells you is that these men aren't unable to make sperm, which was what was thought. It just seems to be that the reservoir of stem cells they had when they were growing up has just failed to renew. And so they've lost basically the cells that would give them sperm when they're older. Now, what this work opens the door to, which is actually really exciting, is that you may be able to take skin cells from these men, convert them into a stem cell-like state, and transfer them into their own testes, and then see if they will then grow into mature sperm, which would be healthy enough to use to have babies. And so it's really the first time that people have thought it might be possible to return some kind of fertility to men with that particular kind of condition.
And how often would you, you know, as an infertile man and you were being given the stem cell treatment, how often would you need to have these cells introduced in that way? Because presumably it's not going to kickstart sort of sperm production. You'd have to have a continued sort of treatment.
Yeah, I mean, one of the scientists I spoke to said that what you might be able to do is if you inject, and in this experiment they were injecting 1.5 million cells into the mice. Now, if you did that into the man and those cells survived, they may give you a few months, even a year, of producing mature sperm. Now, those numbers are going to be small. So what I suspect you would then want to do is look to see if the mature sperm are produced in the man after doing this procedure. And then you would probably do a process called ICSI, where you would be actually taking the sperm out of the man rather than or using an IVF process. You'd be taking the sperm and injecting them individually into eggs and going through the sort of the IVF process rather than banking on natural reproduction, which is just woefully inefficient and a pretty poor hit rate. So that I think is the way you'd go forward with this. What's pretty interesting about this from the UK point of view is that we have a law over here that was given in 2008 in the HFEA Act, which says that it's illegal to use artificial sperm. But then you come down to, well, what is the definition of artificial sperm? And it means, in the wording of that, it's sperm that are created outside the body, because there was a fear that you might be able to create sperm from cells in a dish and that these may have such abnormalities with them that you would then, the idea that you would then go on to use them to create babies could be problematic and you'd want to do some controls over that. This technique, it's unclear, but it may actually not fall foul of that law, because what you'd be doing is you'd be taking a skin cell from the man, reprogramming it to a more immature state, a stem cell state, and then putting those cells back in his body. And so the sperm cells would actually be created in his body. So it may actually be legal to do this if they can sort around out the technological problems with it. And there are some technological problems that they've got to get over.
One of the questions I have about that, and it sort of ties into that point, is, you know, how similar to sperm that is normally produced in the testes would that be? Would you ever be able to trace it back to the fact that it was produced in a slightly unusual route? And could that potentially have impacts on the viability of an embryo? Or
I think that's all up for grabs. I mean, what you've got so far is these researchers were really surprised to see that the human cells, once they had turned them into stem cells, they were really surprised to see them develop into these early stage sperm cells. Now, why didn't they go to maturity? Well, they think that's because of just they were in mouse physiology. And so if you put them in human, it may well be that they go to full maturity. Whether they will be identifiably different to healthy men's sperm, I don't know. And nor do they. What they certainly will have is they'll carry the same mutation. Mm-hmm. So if you did have, if you were able to use IVF and some of those procedures to have a child with those sperm, the children born, any males, would carry that Y chromosome mutation and they themselves would be infertile.
And presumably what they still don't know is whether in men with this condition, whether in their testes they will develop, there's still a question mark over whether these stem cells when transplanted into them will actually develop, or whether the condition actually also affects the ability to develop stem cells that are present.
They've got an idea of that, because what they did this with infertile men, but they also did it with fertile men. And when you do it with skin cells from fertile men, you get far more of the sperm being produced in the mice testes. Now, if you do it with infertile men, yeah, the numbers were much smaller. But again, if you're going through an IVF technique, as long as you have mature sperm, you can get hold of them and run them through and fertilize some eggs.
Just in terms of overall fertility research, how significant is this breakthrough?
Well, it's interesting because if you... And for strange reasons, an awful lot of research that goes on in fertility is aimed at female infertility. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different reasons for that. I mean, there are some that are very justified in that female fertility is traditionally seen as being more complicated than male fertility. But it's also that an awful lot of men work in this area, or did historically, and that they always just seem to go and try and find out what was wrong with the woman. But if you look at couples that go to IVF clinics, an andrologist was telling me yesterday that in 50% of cases there will be a question mark over the male fertility. So, and about 20% of men are producing low sperm counts in terms of clinically low sperm counts. So I think there has been some bias in the past about, you know, focusing more on female fertility, and you know, the problems are well known about what happens with female fertility, you know, post 35, 40, 45, things like that. But this is what's interesting about this is that it's actually looking at an issue of male infertility that really doesn't get much attention. And I don't think there was really much hoped for in the past, because they really misunderstood what the problem was. The problem wasn't that these men had never been able to produce sperm. It was just that they had lost the ability in older age when they turn up at fertility clinics. Finally, we turn to Kew Gardens, which we spoke about last week, but this week it's not about budget cuts, but about Kew's seed bank and how we can safeguard our food supply. Nicola, you've written this for Observer Tech Monthly. Tell us more.
Well, I went down to Kew's Millennium Seed Bank in Wakehurst, which is in Sussex, and I saw what they're doing there, which is a fantastic, fantastic project. And what they're basically doing is they have sub-zero vaults, which they store important seeds in. And one of the projects that I was looking at in particular was one looking at crop wild relatives. And this is part of their Adapting Agriculture to Climate Change project. And basically what they're doing is they work with partners on every continent. So there's countries on every continent that are involved in this. And they work with these partners to go out and collect seeds from wild relatives of plants that we rely on for our food supply. So whether that's wheat or maize, barley. And the reason they do this is because they estimate that 80% of our calories come from just 12 species of plants. So we're very reliant in general on quite a narrow selection of crops. And one of the problems with this is that basically as we have bred cultivated varieties, we've lost a lot of genetic diversity from the plant. And that's sort of part of domestication process called the domestication bottleneck. But the problem with that is that it leaves us quite vulnerable. And that could be to things like changing climate, could mean that a crop that we would typically grow might be at risk from rising temperatures. It might not produce such high yields anymore if the temperature increases. Or it could be that a disease or a pest becomes more common, and that could cause problems as well. So what they're looking for is to safeguard that genetic diversity by making sure that we have a supply of these crop wild relatives. And this is particularly important because they estimate that only 50% of their target species are in either in a seed bank somewhere. Obviously, Kews is not the only seed bank around there. And that 50% are not actually properly collected. And so a lot of the habitats for these plants are under threat as well. So if we don't get them now, we might lose the opportunity to bank that genetic diversity. So this is a really interesting aspect of food security. It's about making sure that we actually have sort of that genetic variety available.
How many species have they got seeds for, and what's their target?
Well, they're looking at 29 crops, and basically this means 450 species, they say, in around 30 countries, which they're aiming to collect in the next 4 years. So obviously one crop can have many different crop wild relative species.
And so what are some of the stranger ones they've got down there? And weren't you eating some of them?
Well, so in terms of the seed bank, these are pretty mainstream crops, so sort of barley, maize, wheat. But Kew is also aware that there are, you know, other plants out there. And in fact, as I said, there are several institutions that are looking at whether we should be trying to diversify what we eat. One of those is an organisation called Crops for the Future that have their new Crops for the Future Research Centre under development in Malaysia. And I spoke to the researchers out there, and they are looking at, you know, how one would create a market and for less common fruits. So these are things I tried this durian fruit, which is pungent, I think, is probably the euphemistic expression. It's pretty whiffy stuff. But, I mean, it's got an interesting flavour. I mean, for me, it had tasted a bit like a kind of sweet, oniony tang to it. But people have described it in all sorts of ways. But this is a fruit with you know, huge amount of nutrients and things, and which is extremely popular in Asia. One of the problems, however, and this is, there are lots of problems with the idea of getting us to branch out. One of them is a demand. The other is, even if you put it in the supermarkets, people might not know what to do with it and therefore might just not buy it. Another more practical things like, can you ensure a supply to meet, you know, a global demand? Can you transport the fruit or vegetable? What kind of scale can you produce it on? All of these questions go into the idea of developing a new crop for global consumption. So it's not a simple thing. One area where this is, you know, could be more immediately helpful, perhaps, is for subsistence farmers who rely entirely on their crops for their food supply. And often, you know, changing climate or pest problem could be absolutely devastating. So encouraging subsistence farmers to grow more than one kind of crop and a crop that's good for that environment is quite important.
How are they related, or how are they different to what's happening at the Svalbard seed bank?
Okay, so as far as I'm aware, the Svalbard seed bank is more of just a vault. So you collect the seeds and they go in, and that's that. Whereas Kew does a lot of germination tests. It looks at the conditions under which the seeds germinate. It looks at sort of the viability and the vigour of the seeds. It makes them very much available for research. So it's a slightly different setup. The Svalbard seed bank, as far as I'm aware, is more of a kind of deep storage security sort of vault.
Thanks for that, Nicola. What else have you got coming up in Tech Monthly this week?
Well, it's a fantastic issue. This month we have an interview with Chris Addison all about how he uses technology and how that influences being an actor and a comedian. We have a fantastic piece on the Candy Crush phenomenon. So all you Candy Crush gamers out there, you should definitely take a look. And we have a really interesting piece that I think would be of interest to anyone in the working world, which is on data in the office. So this is about how you can use data and technology to create a better workplace. or perhaps not. It's about looking at how you can personality match your workers, your staff. So when you're recruiting, you don't just want to know about the skills people have, you want to know if they're going to fit with your team. And they've come up with a lot of ways of using algorithms and tests to see how, you know, people's personalities and whether they'll really fit in or whether they'll be a, you know, they'll rub people up the wrong way. And there's also another side to this, which is the fact that certain employers are now looking at using technology to monitor their staff. So whether this is who you're talking to and how you're talking to them and what that says about your relationships in the office, through to, you know, the potential for monitoring your staff outside of work. You know, are they living a healthy lifestyle? Is that making them a productive person in the office? Is that, you know, moving the company forward? So there's lots of different aspects to this. So whether this is a benefit or a big brother depends very much on your perspective.
Do they need to be very intrusive to get that information, or do they just rely on people shedding this kind of information on Facebook and Twitter and whatnot?
Well, I think with things like, you know, the fit bands and smart bands that people can wear now, I mean, there have already been cases of people, of companies asking staff to use certain monitors in the office to look at the time that they're spending on their coffee break or loo breaks or whatever. So it doesn't necessarily have to be hacking into your Facebook. I think that's yeah, there's far more techniques than that.
Terrifying stuff. Many thanks to Jessica and Nicola. To read those stories, just go to theguardian.com/science or theguardian.com/environment. And Observer Tech Monthly will be out this coming Sunday. The Galapagos Islands have become entwined in the history of one of mankind's greatest ideas, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. Just off the Ecuadorian coast, the Galapagos are both a UNESCO World Heritage Site and a living laboratory for scientists. Author and journalist Henry Nichols' recent book, The Galapagos, is probably the most up-to-date overview of its history, until some weeks ago, because Henry has joined me to explain why recent research into sea levels has revealed another twist in the tale of evolution. Welcome to Science Weekly, Henry.
Thank you very much for having me.
What was this research all about then?
Essentially, thinking about what the Galapagos might have looked like in past eras. So when we look at the islands and the map and you imagine this group of maybe 12 islands, we sort of assume it's all relatively fixed. Of course, we know it's not, but if sea levels are rising and falling, what did that do to the islands? And actually, the platform that the islands are on is relatively shallow. And so these authors actually estimate that in past ice ages, when a lot of the sea had been locked up and the levels fall by a long way, some of these islands in Galapagos coalesced, so became connected. So the islands were actually maybe just one massive blob in the middle of the archipelago. And then the really interesting thing to think about is, how did stuff evolve then? You know, things could then move around between islands. So that isolation that we assume to be very, very important. Well, it is very important in Galapagos. It's a bit more complicated than that.
Does that undermine some of the work that's been done and some of the theories that have been built up around how the species did end up in the various places, how they did evolve? Because it doesn't take into account this variability that may have just shaken up their environment quite dramatically, that may have provided land bridges between one distinct island now and another distinct island.
It doesn't really undermine what's gone before, and that's just because most of what's gone before has gone on birds, and birds can fly, so they're not affected by this these islands coming and going. And the groups that really are affected are the tiny reptiles, the little lizards, and the land iguanas. And actually, those are groups which have not had a lot of research on. So the patterns of their evolution, we don't know that much about. And now, with these kind of insights, or with this extra thing to think about, I suspect the whole story for those small reptiles will make a lot more sense.
I've never been to the Galapagos, but I'd assumed that they were actually really quite, that they dropped off, the water dropped off quite steeply, that they were quite sort of almost shards coming out the sea, and that there was deep water around them. But you're saying they're actually on quite a shallow shelf. When just describe how it looks. I mean, is this shelf, how far under the seawater today is that?
It's only about 145 meters down. So in the center of the archipelago, there's what they call the Galapagos platform, which is this relatively shallow water. And then beyond, when you go beyond that platform, then it does get very deep very quickly. So to the west of the islands, it shelves straight down. And then beyond the platform. So it's really that's the central island, central group of islands that would have been affected by this rising and falling of the oceans.
So how will this affect how scientists see the Galapagos and see the biodiversity there?
I think it's another thing to think about. There's a whole lot of interesting things that are raised by this. So you predict if the submarine realm had been exposed in the past, periodically, probably every 100,000 years or so, the sea levels are dropping to such an extent that large amounts of the submarine world are being exposed. We'd be able to detect signs that that had happened. Now, there's a couple of studies. There's one from the 1990s where they found evidence of certain types of rocks and smooth boulder-like rocks that you only get when things are exposed to the atmosphere and the elements. And so there's some evidence there. So geologists will have a field day with this, thinking about what this means for them. Certainly, I think it will interest the herpetologists, people studying small reptiles. And, for plants and some of the other species, it's not so relevant.
The kind of frequency you're talking about, every 100,000 years or so, isn't huge on a sort of evolutionary time frame. And if this were going on in the past, wouldn't you see the similar looking species on scattered islands?
That is what you do see. And so at least for those particular groups. So there was an American called John Vandenberg at the beginning of the 20th century, and he was still proposing then this very 19th century idea of land bridges. And what he was arguing was that there had to have been a land bridge that connected the Galapagos to mainland South America. That's how stuff got out there. And there were some other proponents of that. But Darwin really sort of hammered that idea and destroyed that bridge, really, by showing just how mobile species were, how seeds could float and survive seawater, how spiders could float in the air and travel great distances, how mollusks could latch onto the feet of birds and probably how tortoises would have floated. And so that main land bridge, the idea of a connection between South America, we ditched it, but we ditched this other idea of little bridges within the islands. And in fact, those probably have existed and had an important impact on the evolution of some of the small reptiles. It's complicated because you have this sort of speciation when the sea levels rise and you get these islands with. So you get degrees of speciation and then degrees of coming together, and if they've not been separated and haven't evolved sufficiently, you'll get hybridization and complicated stuff like that. The clearest one is with the Galapagos snakes. There's two main species that we recognize, and then within each of those species there's a whole lot of subspecies, and that initial speciation event that created two species was probably pegged to a low back about 138,000 years ago. There was a low point when there was probably a common ancestor of these two species. Then the water rose, dividing them, allowing a speciation event. You get two species. And then at 20,000 years ago, the last low, they all came back together. So now you've got these two species coexisting, and they spread to all the different little bits of island, and then the sea level rises again, isolating, and then you get subspeciation within those species happening. Mm. So that was kind of a neat story from the paper.
So how are scientists going to respond to this? What are they going to do with this? Do you think it'll be controversial?
I don't think it really is, and what really surprises me is that no one came up with this before. I mean, it's such an obvious idea. Everybody would say the sea level comes and goes. We know that. So the only thing you've got to factor in is, well, actually, did that expose elements of this submarine world? And sea level rise and fall on its own probably didn't, but there are other factors which they put into their model, such as the subsidence and the weight of water has an impact on the depth. And so if those are factored in, then it just does change the archipelago.
Who did that work on the sea level rises?
A couple of researchers, Jason Ali at the University of Hong Kong and Jonathan Aitchison at the University of Sydney. It will be really interesting to see if further studies replicate this and support this idea, and then it could become it could actually be applied to a lot of other low-lying archipelagos like the Maldives or the Cape Verde Islands.
I can't let you go without asking you about the giant tortoises. And Lonesome George popped his clog some time ago now. What is the situation with other giant tortoises on those islands now?
Pretty good. If you go back to when conservationists first started sort of scouting out and seeing how the previous two centuries of killing tortoises to eat them had affected the populations, things were in a pretty desperate situation with Lonesome George's species effectively extinct, a couple of others already extinct, and the Española tortoise, for example, there were just 15 animals. And now we've got 2,000 of those, so that's all a result of a captive breeding effort. The Pinzon tortoises is a very small island, but it's its own distinct species of tortoise there. When they turned up in the 1960s to look at those, they just found old tortoises, really old tortoises. I mean, this was like an old tortoise home, and there had been no recruitment into that population for at least 100, probably more, years. So they were breeding these very old tortoises. They were more than 100 years old, still breeding, creating nests, laying eggs. But every year, every time those eggs hatched, or even before, the rats introduced to that island would just destroy them. So there had not been a juvenile tortoise that survived. And so they managed to keep that population going by excavating eggs and then incubating them on a different island in captivity, rearing them till their rat-proof age of about 3 or 4, and then putting them back. And then in 2013, there was a big effort to eradicate rats using a sort of rodenticide that's scattered all over that island. And in 2013, the first hatchlings actually emerged and survived on their island. So we think that island is now rat-free, and that kind of restoration initiative is something that's being rolled out across to bigger and bigger islands progressively.
The Galapagos have had some pretty enormous problems with all manner of invasive species. They've been doing goat culls and things like that. And how successful are these things proving? Are they working out?
Immensely successful. I think they've kind of, at least within goat eradication circles, they've made their name. These islands have the record for eradicating, clearing such large areas on islands, at least, of goats. And it's an incredibly long campaign, the goat campaign from 1998 to about 2005. It's sort of serious phase, and hundreds of thousands of animals killed and removed from huge islands. I mean, Northern Isabella, Isabella's the largest island. It's about 150 kilometres long, I think. And, most of that is now clear. And Lonesome George's Island is a good example, a great example. So that, they think, it was just fishermen putting down three goats in the 1950s. And those three goats obviously did what goats do. And in the 1970s, when they began to try and deal with this problem, the Galapagos National Park shot more than 40,000 goats on that island. That island is just 7 miles long or something like that, and 3 or 4 miles wide. It's tiny. 40,000 goats in a decade all descended from these three. And that rumbled on, and they didn't actually get them all till about 2003. If you just leave one pregnant goat, then that's not good enough.
Presumably they're wiping out the plant life, which has the impact on the other animals.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the downside is that the goats are quite often introduced deliberately or maliciously. So there's an element of sabotage and within the islands, because people who don't support the conservation idea, because they think it's against the development within the islands, which it kind of is, will use or have used goats as a sort of political tool, so threatening to introduce into some of the pristine islands. So
Between 1990 and 2011, there were something like 12 intentional introductions of feral goats, so an average one every 20 months. And then the cost of removing these goats is phenomenal. I mean, it averages out at only $5,000 per goat, but some of these have been very, very costly just to remove one or two goats from an island. So, and this, of course, with those introduced species, there's a problem. You've removed them, but you can't let up on that vigilance. It's not a problem that goes away. And obviously, rats are going to be even harder to keep out once you've got rid of them.
Mm. So how is it looking today? Is the Galapagos a good news story?
It's a difficult thing to write about when you've sort of... my editor said, you've got to call it how you feel it, which is, you know, correct, of course. And so I wrote the first draft, I sent it in, and he said, you can't say that. So it was my first take on it, very dismal. And at certain times I do feel, you know, this wonderful place, you know, the problems are just so vast and so intractable. But I have come to a different ending, partly because he asked me, but I really genuinely came to a different place, which I feel much, much happier about. And it was just doing a thought experiment. Historians hate this kind of counterfactual stuff, but it's just, what if the conservation movement hadn't settled upon the Galapagos as one of its really iconic places that it was going to focus on? So what if there was not such a strong conservation movement in the Galapagos? And that was just interesting to think through how the Galapagos would look today. And I think in some ways it wouldn't look that different. There'd still be lots of great stuff to see, but the human footprint on the islands would be much, much greater and much more widespread. So the islands would just... Hawaii's great, but the islands would look more sort of uniform and more like Hawaii. So the people everywhere, really. And what we actually have is this remarkable situation where humans, are a lot of them, 30,000 admittedly, living there now, but contained within just 3% land mass. And so most of Galapagos, and certainly all but two of the islands, are really still pretty pristine. Two of the islands are very, very heavily damaged, and they're big islands, and there's a lot of biodiversity that's affected by those islands. But elsewhere, there's some great things, and there's a lot that we can do. So there's good and bad, and so it becomes just a question of, well, do we say the whole thing's you know, being destroyed, or do we do something about it? And I think once you admit that what we've done in the past has made a difference, then it's easy.
Henry, thanks so much for coming in and talking about all of this. The Galapagos by Henry Nichols is published by Profile Books and out in all good on and offline bookshops. To read Henry's zoology blog, Animal Magic, go to the Guardian Science Blog Network at theguardian.com/science and click on blogs. And he's speaking at the Hay Festival on 29th of May. We'll have links to all of that on the blog for this podcast. That's all we have for you this week. A huge thanks for listening. Please tweet us with your thoughts at Science Weekly. But from me, Ian Sample, and producer Jason Phipps, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.